Hello and welcome to The Dorothy Project, the interview podcast celebrating women's impact on queer culture. My name's Alice Beverton-Palmer, and as a DJ myself at London's Push the Button, I'm especially passionate about the power of nightlife for the queer community. Today's interviewee, Rita, has proven this point better than maybe anyone else I've ever met. The combination of her own life experiences, her career as a psychologist, and with Club Carly has created something very special. I think every single queer Asian person I've interviewed for this podcast or even spoken to socially has mentioned it. That's an incredible legacy for one club night to have. But Club Carly has a dynamic future as well as an important past, and I started by asking about that.
The Dorothy Project with Alice Beverton-Palmer.
I hear Club Carly is back, which is incredibly exciting. So what does it look like post-pandemic? What should people expect?
Oh, wow. Well, the core part of Club Carly, which is the energy, the home away from home, the community connections and the celebration, that is definitely still there. We're kind of roving a bit in the sense that we used to be, when we started, like in one place at the Dome, which was our home, and then we moved around a little bit, and then we moved to central London, and we've had summer boat parties. So part of this has been to enable people to access us from different parts of the country, so being more central just makes it easier. But one of the things we've noticed during the pandemic, post-lockdown, is that we reached people across the globe. Like, people were like zooming in from all over the planet, which was such a joy. People were, you know, signing in from San Francisco, Norway, Dubai. I was like, whoa, okay. So and of course, you know, within Europe and UK. So one of the things we decided is that, right, we're going to carry on online events, but they're not going to be the parties because lockdown's lifted. We're having our physical real life events, which are celebratory. But we recognized during lockdown that people found Zoom was a really intimate space. And you could get to know people on a different level. And we thought, wow, this is really good, because in a club night pre-COVID, you celebrated, you danced, you met, you chatted, and you danced some more, but you didn't really get that space to have a conversation. So we noticed that Zoom provided that. And secondly, a lot of the well-being workshops and meditation, to talking about sex, to talking about taboos, to talking about identity, to really having that space, it meant that people could fast track their personal journey. So Club Carly has always been that safe space where we almost like hold your hand whilst you go through your journey of discovery, embracing yourself, loving yourself, accepting yourself, and having that community who reinforce that you're worth it, you're special, you're loved, you're accepted, you can exist, you know, all of those things that happened once a month in a club setting. But now we can fast track it through these events. So in a way, it's just amazing that we can do that.
That fact that the medium has such a big impact on what you can actually do. And I think it's interesting because a lot of people talk about the centrality of kind of clubbing and the scene to the queer experience. Mm. And it's kind of cool that you found other ways of connecting people and doing, you know, getting people to where you want to get them. That's great.
It was difficult because one of the things we realized with Zoom is that you could get anyone joining and you didn't really know who they are. Whereas at the club nights, we can physically see people and explain our policy. It's a you know, safe queer space, etc. And you get a sense if somebody isn't in the right place, or, you know, if they're not right, you kind of have that sense when you meet someone at the door and you're going through the policy and checking in, you don't have that on Zoom. So we have had to be really clear about our rules. You know, Club Carly rules. Yeah, people kind of sigh, think, oh God, not more rules. But one of them is that you have to show yourself on camera. And some people found that a bit strange and uncomfortable. But ultimately, I think, you know, safe space is our core value. It's one of our ethos in terms of how we operate and the space we provide. So on Zoom, people have to show themselves, otherwise they can't stick around and take part. So that's been a bit of a mixed bag. But on the whole, we've been able to translate our physical events online with added value. So that's just for us. It's just been great. Yeah.
So creating a safe space to you and these rules, like what does that mean to you? Where does that come from? Tell me about that.
Well, my background's in domestic abuse. I've worked in the charity sector, supporting women fleeing domestic abuse, domestic violence, and then also training and awareness, and set up the national LGBT domestic violence helpline as well. So a lot of the support that we offer victims is around risk assessments and making yourself safe. So safety has always been core to the way I think and the way we work. And we all know that in terms of whether you go to counselling or any kind of support, in order to nurture yourself to grow, a human being needs to feel safe, whether that's a physical space or emotionally safe, or in your therapist, you know, chair with your therapist, you feel safe and not judged and so on. So, and through my own journey of counseling and so on, and, you know, having psychiatrists turn around to me and saying, oh, you're just like this because of your past abuse and, you know, experiences and so on. And I'm like, well, you know, not really. So for me, it's really, really key for someone to feel comfortable and open. You've got to enable that trust and that safety, that sense of we're not here to judge you, but you can actually just breathe that sigh of relief and offload, and all the pretense and the protection mechanisms and who you have to be and how you have to appear and your do's and don'ts of how we navigate through life as we are discovering ourselves, whether that's as a woman, as a queer person, as a Black person, as a disabled person. You know, we're constantly building ourselves in a way that fits, and that takes effort and energy, and it's at a high emotional cost. So when you can let all of that go and breathe, then you have space, and then you can embark on a journey to discover who you are, what feels good, to reconnect with your sense, with your spirit, your soul, your humanity. And that's really important to me. And I don't know where I got that from, but that's just really important to me. And maybe because I've been searching for that most of my life, when I found it, I'm like, my God, this needs to be shared. So Club Carly, the safe space, is absolute core. I will not compromise on that. You know, it's not negotiable. And then we make these rules because that's what we wanted to create.
That's amazing. I've never heard of anything so proactive in terms of creating that kind of environment for people. Tell me how it started, Club Carly. So it's a legendary mainstay of the UK's queer clubbing scene. It's groundbreaking. It was, I think, the UK's first Asian gay club. So yeah, for those who haven't been, tell us the story. How did it start?
Well, it's an interesting story in that when I moved to London, I used to flick through Time Out and look for spaces where I could hear music and go to spaces that were mixed, that were not just white spaces with hardcore house music, because that wasn't something I identified with. That wasn't something I wanted. And so I went into this underground club amongst other, you know, various clubs, and I found DJ Ritu playing you know, Asian Bollywood music, because there was a sort of community disco space that was there before. But it wasn't necessarily a safe space. And anyway, I went up to DJ Rita and said, can you play ABBA, Dancing Queen? And she just looked at me and glared at me. And I thought, but that's the music I want to hear. I want happy music. You know, I think eventually she played ABBA, but that was the start of my inspiration, in that I wanted music that made me happy and it was uplifting. But I also wanted a space that I could walk into, because there were so many spaces where I was questioned based on the way I looked, which was, you know, long hair, makeup, very feminine. And there was a lot of mistrust. Could, you know, why was I coming into these spaces which were full of what I called, you know, Hackney dykes, women with short hair, Doc Martens, jeans and no makeup, and there was a standard, and there was an image, and there was a way that you had to look in order to access certain spaces, and I didn't fit that, so had to create my own. So with DJ Ridhu, a brilliant DJ, I just thought, yeah, you've got the music, I've got the rest of it. And have it being a psychologist as well, and having a fascination with human nature and what makes us tick and what we need and how we work. I think the two just complemented each other. So Ridhu was in her element, playing the music she loved, which was mainly Bollywood and world music, with real kind of drum beats and some of the music that we grew up with. And it's an interesting journey, because as an Asian woman, having left home, I rejected everything about me, but I grew up with it. So it's in my DNA. It's part of my identity. But I rejected it because it was just loaded with all the patriarchal rules and issues and how to be. And I just thought, oh, bollocks to that. You know, it didn't define me, but it left me in a space, in a kind of void, where of course the colors and the music and the sounds were part of my identity, and I rejected that, but there was something that connected my humanity to that, and whilst I resisted it and didn't want any part of it, I reclaimed it eventually. It's a bit like how we've all reclaimed words or vocabulary and identities, and you know, the words like homosexual or dykes and queer and all of those things that, you know, we've reclaimed. And later on my journey, I thought, well, hang on a minute. I haven't compromised my feminine identity. Although having said that, I did attend a pride with my hair tied back, no makeup, wearing dungarees and a pair of Doc Martens, and my friends just rolled about in laughter, thinking, what have you done? Because there's me trying to be a proper dyke. But anyway, aside that, I thought, well, if I'm not going to compromise on that, on this, why would I compromise on other things? So yes, so gradually over time, I started to reclaim and redefine and reinvent the colors, the sparkles, the clothing, the outfits, the music, and even the dance. And I think to some degree, I was inspired by other forms of dance, like, you know, like world music, belly dancing, some of the clubs that were around, and also came about. And I thought, yeah, you know, this is the music I want. I mean, you know, I'm a diehard salsa fan as well. And as soon as I moved to London, you know, the main clubs where I could get those music was straight clubs, and I'd go along to straight clubs and it was horrendous, but I love the music, so I love dancing, and it was a weird thing because I didn't like the space being mauled and all the rest of it, but I love the music, so it had to be a safe space. Otherwise, how else? If I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it 100% well. So the two kind of just came together, and then lots of things just layered into that. And Club Kali was born.
And clearly it resonated with so many other people, because, you know, when I've spoken to other Asian people for this podcast, they, so many people have said, you know, that it's the first kind of Asian gay club that I went to, and what a part of, as you say, their journeys it was. Mm. And it's been a stalwart for how long now has it been?
Gosh, we are 26 now, 26 years. Officially, we are 26. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, in the old days, we used to, I think partly because of this, I felt like the godmother on the door, you know, like screening and checking and then checking inside and checking outside. And I think part of our kind of core value being that safe space was what made it work. So we did get reporters and, you know, Channel 4 and BBC, and we got people wanting to come in to write about it. We didn't advertise it. We refused to have any listings or information out there in the mainstream public media. So it was kind of carried through right across the board. And I think that's how people felt safe. So it was like a secret society and club, although not so secret, because people were flying in from all over the world and checking in their suitcases at the cloakroom. But we got coaches from like Birmingham and Leicester and Manchester, and people would like get together and hire coaches, and then the coaches would travel down and people would spill out and they would have the night of freedom. And then, you know, they would go off. But we took care of people. We made sure that when they left, they were safe. They were with people. If people came on their own, they were connected to other people and so on. So I think word spread very, very quickly. And you're right. I mean, you know, it became so well known. And yet we tried to keep it a secret. But it was like well known with the people that mattered, for the people for whom we were there. And so in that regard, it worked.
Amazing. And I want to go back to what you said about kind of your philosophy and finding yourself. And, yeah, you know, you moved away, you moved to London. So tell me about that. Where did you come from to become who you are now?
Well, I grew up in London, but unfortunately, growing up here in the late 70s, 80s, it was a case of women got married, did the 2.2 kids and the usual. And I decided somewhere deep within me that wasn't what I wanted. That was not the package for me. So I left home, and it was, you know, all of disgrace and all of that. But part of me was lost, in the sense that when I left, I lost the ability to speak my language because I didn't have anyone else with whom I spoke my language. So for many years, I didn't utter a single word in my mother tongue, in my mother language. I just spoke English. I created new English friends. I went out of London, got myself educated, which was the no, you didn't do that. I came back, and it took a decade or so before, you know, I sort of rebuilt my relationship with my family and so on. And now everything's hunky-dory and great. However, that decade or two was fraught with identity crisis, a loss of not just culturally, who am I, where do I belong, do I belong anywhere, all of that stuff. And I think my journey, I went to uni to study psychology in order to understand, why am I the way I am? Why am I different? What gives me the right to bring so much pain and suffering and break the norms and not conform? You know, I must be a bad person. And so I went from there to actually, there are historical figures that were hidden, and because of, you know, preventing girls being educated and all of that, there is a whole world out there. And once I started to access all of those things, history, you know, just tales in in our culture, the goddesses and just everything, whether it's factual or not, you know, the stories. I thought, no, of course there's another way to be, of course there's another life out there. But when you grow up and you're constrained, it's like having balls and chains around you and your world is like tunnel vision. It's horrible. It really is horrible. It's like growing up blind. And I'm such a big advocate of education, because education was my doorway to existing. I honestly would not be here had I not had access to that. I would not be here. You know, I tried to top myself, and then there was just the constraints of having to live a closed lifestyle that was dictated by patriarchy was just awful. And I look back and I think, how do women do it? How do they do it? But we have, as human beings, we have a fighting spirit. I think it's like a light. And once you have a glimpse of light, something gets turned on inside you, and there's a drive to follow it and to make it brighter. And as it gets brighter, your soul grows and grows stronger, and you grow. And I think it's all of that. But honest to God, if I had not left home, saved up money, got myself to uni, and then discovered this world at uni, I would not be here today, and Club Carly wouldn't be here today.
That's made me feel really emotional.
I mean, I'm surprised that even now when I share it, I get all teary, but it was just that fine line.
Yeah. It's incredibly powerful, I think, as well. You don't necessarily realize the impact that you can have on other people, whether that's, you know, stories like you say of goddesses or people through history. And yeah, you know, you hear those and you just, sometimes it makes me feel slightly insane when I think about all the women through history who've been so constrained. And yeah, so powerful to see that they found their way, and that people have just, like you say, just had this attitude that's just, fuck it, I can't live in those constraints. I guess the other element I wanted to ask you about was, you know, as a woman and within the patriarchy, you know, so many women I've spoken to for this podcast about their experiences kind of on the queer scene, there are common threads of how patriarchy kind of plays out within that. And I wondered, in setting up Club Carly, two women setting that up, how was that experience? You know, how have you found being a woman within the kind of the queer world?
It was an interesting mixed bag. When we set it up, and when I, even pre-Carly, when I was, you know, flicking through Time Out magazine and finding women-only spaces to go and to connect with my sisters, with other women, and being a strong feminist as well, it almost felt like I had permission to do that. You know, if I could say I'm a feminist, there's a label, and therefore I belong to a community of feminists. It's such a shame that we went through a period where feminism was a dirty word, and young women, you know, say, oh, they don't need to be a feminist, and so on. You know, but that aside, I think when you give yourself a label or a name, there's an identity that's enforced or reinforced, and you find a connection with like-minded people. So my journey in the early days was almost like easy, because I found women-only spaces that were accepting of who I am and who I was. So that was good. But within the club setting, because I'd gone through uni and I'd overcome all those doubts, and that I wasn't allowed to be, but I was literally, you know, that door was half open, and no one was going to slam it shut in my face. Absolutely no one. There is just no way on hell that would have happened, or on any universe. I was embracing my strength and my feminine energy. And so in a way, it was like, I connected with Carly, the feminine energy of fighting and protecting and being fierce. And I was really protective of the space at Club Carly because it was my space as much as anyone else's space. So the more I put into it, I knew people were getting out of it. But it was also a two-way street. Being in that space was validating my identity too, and who I am and my community. So it felt good. It felt strengthening. It felt empowering. And I took no nonsense. It was just like, no, you know, if anyone misbehaved, I didn't think twice about it. And it's so interesting that as I got older and the invent of the internet and everything else came about, and then we started getting all this hate crime and, you know, incidents against LGBT people have gone up in recent years. And it's so bizarre that we're kind of going backwards. And I feel possibly, if I had to compare myself, I'd say I'm more cautious now about threats and issues and concerns and oppression. It takes up more space than it used to. And that, I think, is really sad, because as humanity and as society, I always hope that we progress. And we have, you know, we've made huge strides legally, visibility, and so on. But equally, I wouldn't just blame it on the internet, but, you know, I do think that there is a lot of hate and intolerance and oppression and judgment, and maybe because we're stronger, you know, the forces that seek to oppress us have also got stronger. Just hope we don't end up blowing each other up, but you know. So in terms of as a woman, I found it much easier to connect with my sense of strength as a woman and my feminine strength. I found it much easier then. But of course, you know, as you get older as well, you have less tolerance for rubbish. It's like, nah, not dealing with that.
There's a part of me that hopes with, because I think you're absolutely right, there's been a measurable rise in hate crime in the UK in the last kind of 5 years. And obviously government policy is becoming more and more anti-LGBT. And there's a part of me that kind of hopes that it's a backlash against progress. And that's kind of weirdly a sign that progress has happened, and that you just have these kind of forward, two steps forward, one step back. But it's a very scary situation to be in as it's happening, and you can see that change. It seems very weird that, you know, what was it, about 8 or 9 years ago, equal marriage was brought in by a conservative government. And now that just this current government, it just seems unthinkable that they would take such a like bold stand to do something liberal. Finally, as I ask everyone I speak to, nominate another Dorothy who I should profile, whether that's someone that I interview or a figure through history who I can profile on the podcast.
Oh, wow, there's so many. But immediately, I guess, because we've been talking about Club Carly, DJ Riddhu comes to mind, partly because it was DJ Riddhu to whom I went up and I said, please play Dancing Queen. And, you know, Club Carly was born. But I have been blessed when I came to London and started work with the collective, with the women that I worked with. Just ordinary women, but really, really strong women in the refuges that I worked with. Jovanka, Fiona, they were two women that I really looked up to, who were my kind of reference frame where I felt I had permission to be different and it was okay. So they're also my Dorothys. And of course, you know, in terms of all the tales that we hear about and the stories and the goddesses, Club Kali would be the one I'd want you to, I mean, not Club Kali, Kali the goddess would be the one I'd want you to interview. I'd love to hear her take on the world, on the universe.
Yeah, that would be, yeah. I think I'd have to hold on to my pants for that recording.
As you could probably tell, Rita made me really emotional. Some people are just so powerful in what they bring to the world, and I think Rita is one of them. Don't forget to tweet us at Dorothy_podcast and let us know what you thought of the episode and which Dorothy or friend of Dorothy you think I should talk to next. On the next episode, I'm exploring Britain's Black lesbian history with the historian and journalist Paula Akpan. I can't wait. This episode of The Dorothy Project featured DJ Rita as our guest. It was hosted by Alice Beverton Palmer and produced by Laura Blake.